6 o'clock news. What can I do? All those kids without shoes. What can I do? Military coups. What can I do? I'm just a 6 o'clock news.
Well, it's Tuesday again, 6 o'clock, Truth Attack Hour with yours truly, Tyra Antolik, where religion, politics, and the law are mentioned all in one breath. If you would like to call the show, the number is 410-848-9191. And by all means, do visit lwrn.net and truth-attack.com for all kinds of information that would make you a better man and woman. At least you will not be ignorant about the things that are going on around you. And this show is going to be even more informational so that you will not be ignorant about the things that are going on around you. I have with me, like I did last week, Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. Are you there, Brother Gregory?
Yes, I am.
I am so glad that you were able to get on the show today. I was going to answer the questions that Brother Paul saw on my mass email by myself, and he said, hey, would you like to have Brother Paul answer those questions? I said, for sure, if he wants to be on the show again, and I am so glad you're back here with us. I'm going to quickly go through some of these questions that I sent to my e-blast that caught Brother Paul's attention. And these are the questions. Is the kingdom of God a separate government and jurisdiction from those of this world, or is it a subdivision of the United States federal government? Is the kingdom of God subservient to the kingdoms of this world? Is the only nationally and internationally recognized church government the Catholic Church? Can it function, and it being the church generally, not the Catholic Church, can the church function in the world while not being of the world? How do God's people separate themselves from the kingdom of this world in practical ways? Is there a risk in living under the kingdom of God while still in this world? And all of these questions my husband and I discuss and try to come up with some biblical answer to all of these so that we can function. I have in front of me 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the master's sake, that's for Jesus' sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto the governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. A lot of people quote this passage and also quote Romans 13 as an unqualified obedience to civil government. And that really, really bothers me. And I would like for you to discuss that. What is there a qualifier in these passages of Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2:13?
Well, the qualifier is, how does government get jurisdiction over a matter? I mean, the first thing a court does when you're brought into court is they try to establish jurisdiction. They even do this in the Soviet Union. If you're brought into court in the Soviet Union, they want to establish jurisdiction. China, the one-child contract, there's a great example. You can have as many children as you want in China. There's lots of people. I actually have a friend who's married to a girl from China. His wife had like 8 brothers and sisters, including herself. So there was about 7 brothers and sisters, and they lived in the heart of China. And he wasn't a government official or anything. How is he having all these children while other people are being forced to abort their children? Why? Because they signed a one-child contract. This guy never signed the contract. So he could have as many children as he wanted. If you sign the contract, you get all kinds of extra benefits. You get extra schooling, you get extra clothing allowances, extra food allowances, you get special privileges. But once you sign that contract and you get pregnant again, they will drag you into a doctor's office or a hospital or whatever they have there and force you to have an abortion because you've signed the contract. And this, of course, is why the Bible tells us in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods. That's why Jesus says, thou shalt take, you know, no oath. Don't swear not. James says, above all else, take no oath. And they're telling you something. That's instructions from the king. But
right.
Every day people take oaths. Every day they apply for benefits that are contractual. They apply for participation in social welfare schemes that are contractual. And but you see the first century church, there was lots of welfare around at the time of Judea and Rome. Rome, the free bread and circuses of Rome, they were writing poems about it at the time. Hundreds of years before Christ, Polybius and Plutarch were talking about it, that this undermines, the greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. Well, you don't get the benefit unless you sign up. You have to become a member of some sort of Corbin system or Corvey system of benefits that they offered through the temples, which we were told not to participate. Christians wouldn't do it. This is why they were persecuted. They wouldn't sign up at the Roman temples for their social welfare. They wrote extensive apologies in 150 A.D. by Justin, the martyr, explaining a letter to Antoninus Pius, the emperor before Marcus Aurelius, that we gather every week, and those of us who have share with those that are in need. They explain this in early church writings. John the Baptist, if your neighbor has no coat and you have two, share with him. Give him a coat. Do the same in meats. This is what made Christianity distinct. They would not sign up for social welfare systems that were offered by men who called themselves benefactors but exercised authority one over the other. That's a direct quote out of the mouth of Jesus. You are not to be that way. You're not to be like the governments of the Gentiles, the princes and kings of the Gentiles, who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority one over the other. Call no man on earth father. When he said that, he was talking about the Roman Senate and the emperor himself. Who was, the Roman Senate were called conscripted patres, conscripted fathers. Everybody in the crowd knew exactly what he was talking about because they knew. I mean, you see in the Greek text the Latin word patri. He's saying, don't call them your father. Don't pray to them for benefits. Pray to your Father in heaven. How do you get the benefits from your Father in heaven? The love of your fellow Christians who care as much about you and your welfare as they do themselves, which is why the church, right out of the box, is setting up a daily ministration. 200 years ago, if you lost your job, if you got injured and couldn't work, and your family was hungry, where'd you go? You went to church. Today, where do you go? You go to men who call themselves benefactors, but simply exercise authority one over the other, and you can't get the benefit unless you sign a contract.
Okay, hold on a minute right there, because there are two, just within this conversation right now, there are two things that are coming up, and I first want to address my initial question in 1 Peter 2:13. This, to a lot of people, seems like an unqualified obedience to civil government. Unqualified, it says, obey every ordinance of man, of the king and of the governors. Is that
what
it's saying?
We should have never had
unqualified.
An American Revolution. We should immediately write an apology letter to the Queen of England and say, we're sorry for starting the United States. We should have never disobeyed King George. He had an unquestionable authority over us, and we were wrong to have the American Revolution, and we want to be subjects again to Great Britain. But
I've had a professor say that. I asked
him. Well,
I really have. I asked him.
Well,
so he was saying
that all the
quote founding fathers of this country were treasonous.
Well,
so I said to him, So what you're saying is all the founders were treasonous, and he said yes. And I said, okay, I was just checking. And there was silence in the classroom because he could not he couldn't come back with a liner with that. Oh, I was just checking. I wanted to make sure that you were saying that everybody was treasonous about this. But nonetheless, everybody else other than the colonies, today, my mom even says this to me, you have to obey all the ordinances and all the laws unequivocally, unqualified, because that's what Peter says. Is that what that verse is saying?
No, it doesn't say that. And there's actually certain Greek words in the text that they don't translate, so that it's misleading when you read, submit yourself to every ordinance of man. There's several different words that are translated into ordinance, so you have to understand, you know, why they don't suddenly translate a word into ordinance, and when they do, we have a pamphlet on this and an article on 1 Peter 2 that people can go through and look at. And the point is that you're finding one little tiny reference to the fact that he's saying obey every ordinance, yet we know he doesn't mean that you have to do everything Adolf Hitler says or Stalin says. I mean, if he says kill Jews, you don't have to kill Jews. As a matter of fact, it would be criminal of you. I mean, how many people were tried because they said we were just following orders? Even the government admits that you don't have to obey every rule that someone makes. And as far as the American Revolution, we weren't the ones who were revolting. People don't understand their own American history. They've all gone to public school. They have rewritten history books in the last 80 to 100 years. And you don't understand the American Revolution if you think that we were the ones who were revolting. It was George that was revolting. You read the Declaration of Independence. They're talking about unwarranted usurpations. They were saying our charters have already set us free. It wasn't just the charters, but what they were doing, how they were operating in the world. But Americans, the average American who studies American history today in the schools, they don't have any understanding that it was the kings who, even in Parliament itself, I can show you arguments made by members of Parliament saying you can't impose these taxes in America. You can do it anywhere else in the British Empire, but you can't do it in America because of the colonial charters and the status of landed Americans. Now, people don't understand what landed Americans is. It was Americans who actually owned land. They don't know the history of the pilgrims who rejected six different contracts for coming and settling this country until they finally had one that said after 7 years of labor, they could actually own the land itself. Because the definition then and the definition still today in the Oxford Dictionary is that a freeman is someone having a freehold title in land. Untaxable land that he actually owned the land itself, not a legal title, but an actual title to the land itself. You wouldn't be counted as a free man until you did that. So people were coming here to America to own that land, untaxable. And you can, even if you read in March of Democracy, published by the Encyclopedia Britannica, five-volume set of American history, page 45, I think it is. It might be 55. I think it's 45. It talks about the average American living on his land in fee simple, untaxed by all the world. He wasn't untaxed because the king liked him. It's because he had separated himself out.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut in. We're coming up on
a break.
And we'll talk and continue about this wonderful subject. So don't touch that webpage. Do not touch that dial. And I'll be right back with Brother Gregory. Don't go away.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
And that's what this show is about, to let you know what's going down. If you want to call the show, the number is 410-848-9191. And I have with me Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. Thank you and welcome back. We were discussing 1 Peter 2:13.
If you want, I'll run through 1 Peter and just give you some highlights. I don't want to give a Greek lesson here because that gets too confusing. But we read it as submit yourself to every ordinance. That's the very first lines that you read. The very first word is actually un, which is the word for therefore. And they don't translate that word. You can have to go back to the translators and ask them, why didn't you put that word in there? Because what they're saying is, therefore, submit yourself to every ordinance. So you have to go read what was written before to find out what he's saying, why he's saying submit yourself. Because submit is pretty accurate, the word there, submit. Now, the word ordinance is not normally translated ordinance. It appears... I think maybe a half a dozen times in the Bible. It's only more than that, about 19 times in the Bible. And it's only translated ordinance once. Every other place it's translated either creature or creation. So he's saying, submit yourself to every creation of man. And in the use of that particular word, that's you and other men. It's the word ketesis, you and other men creating an institution, because it's actually translated institution, I think, once, or at least building, and it's defined as institution. So if you create, if you become a member of a governmental system, the Shriners or whatever it is, you may submit yourself to the rules of that institution. But you don't have, if you don't join that club, you don't have to submit yourself to that institution. If you're not a member under the authority of that institution, you're not submitting to it. This is why they said, the apostles that are being accused, these are the men who do contrary to the decrees of Caesar and say there is another king. Why? Because they lived in the world but not of the world. And then you have to look at the word world, five different words they translate into world in the New Testament alone. The one they use there means constitutional order and system of government. The apostles were not members of those institutions. Now, let's back up on First Peter 2:13 to verse 12. It says, having your conversation honest amongst the Gentiles, meaning other nations, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, why would they do that? They may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God. They were taking care of the needy of their society with their own daily ministration. They not only did that, but they actually helped out other people in their community outside their own congregations. Their congregations were actually a part of, no longer Greek, no longer citizens of Rome. Paul was not a citizen of Rome. That's another whole chapter that we can explain to you very clearly, that there's no way on earth that Greek text is saying that Paul was a Quirinian citizen of Rome. Quirinian is the term you'd use for citizen of Rome. They use in the Greek text the term Romaios, which did not necessarily mean you were a citizen of Rome. It meant you were whole. It means you were in possession of all your rights. And he was Romeo's. Every centurion was a citizen of Rome, yet the head of the cohort comes to Paul and says, you are Romeo's? I had to pay a great sum for this freedom, for this liberty. Well, he wouldn't have to pay anything for it. He was the head of the court. He'd automatically be a citizen of Rome. But to be Romeo's, to be absolutely whole and not subject to the administration of government. That was a different status entirely. So, you know, there are so many layers of misunderstanding in the Bible, which is why we've had to write so many books. We put them all online for free. You don't have to sign up for anything or sell us anything or give us your credit card number. You can read all the books. There's hundreds of footnotes that explain each of these words that they are misleading you by, so that you have gone and gone under a strong delusion that a lot of people think they are saved because they believe in Jesus, and they haven't even heard the gospel of Jesus yet. They haven't heard what he was talking about. He was talking about how to be free souls under God. You read on in 14, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers. If you go back to Romans 13, he talks about rulers of the earth are there to punish the wicked. Who are the wicked? It's the covetous people who want benefits at the expense of their neighbor, who
but
covet their neighbor's
that doesn't
the agency
in fact,
of government.
Nowadays, it's the other way around. They're punishing those that don't want to be part of that system.
They do, and I'm not going to say that they won't, but they're actually punishing the people who do want to covet their neighbor's goods. They just haven't felt the hammer come down yet. We get a lot of people complaining about what they think is government usurping power. But the fact is, the average Christian's conversation that we see mentioned in verse 12 has not been honest amongst the Gentiles. It has been covetous. They have wanted benefits. It says in the Bible, through covetousness, Peter says this, same guy, through covetousness, they will make merchandise of you. So let's take a word, merchandise, human resource, a surety for debt. You've become merchandise, human resources, surety for debt, nothing but a commodity on the open market because you have been covetous. You have desired free education at the expense of your neighbor. You've desired free health care at the expense of your neighbor. You want a fire department that will come and put the fire out in your house. You didn't create a volunteer fire department that you donate to and that you have fundraisers to support. You put it on the tax rolls. You put your cemeteries on the tax rolls. You force your neighbor every time you turn around to contribute to your benefits, and then you tell me you're a Christian. I'm talking generally, and I know this is shocking to a lot of people, and I'm not holding it against them. I'm trying to be a voice crying in the wilderness to make straight the way of the Lord. We can provide all those benefits with our conversation in the world. I could go into the Greek word conversation there. By faithful charity and the perfect law of liberty, or we can do it by men who exercise authority. If we do it by men who exercise authority, we will be cursed. We will be merchandise. And they will punish us daily.
Okay. Well, I want to veer off a little bit here because I have in front of me, you mentioned this earlier on the first segment, I have an article here, Not So Secure Socialism, and I read it, and I agree with it, especially the paragraph that says, according to the Social Security Tax Act, the government has been under no contractual obligation to make any return payments from the very beginning and has carried the provision that, quote, the right to alter, amend, or repeal any provision of this act is hereby reserved to the Congress. Therefore, quote, Congress could continue to collect the so-called Social Security payroll taxes even though Congress discontinued all Social Security benefit payments. Now, the reason why I read that paragraph is because I believe that anything having to do with the Social Security is not a contract, because doesn't have the elements of a contract, and if it did, it would be already in breach from day one.
Well, actually, you know, that quote wasn't a quote from me. That's a quote I'm quoting somebody else. But the reality is we do this all the time. We have this idea that there are terms of contracts that says, okay, I get to decide this, you get to decide that. And that's true. There is. I mean, you can have a contract with somebody that to use the truck. You can drive it anywhere you want. You can change the direction you want to go in, but you can't do this, 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 and this. The contract with Social Security says they get to change the terms anytime they want. I'll give you another contract that people do every day, and the terms change the very next day after they do it. And that is the marriage contract. Which is the first chapter of the book, Covenants of the Gods. It's Holy Matrimony versus Marriage. It was one of the first things I wrote. I took it to a prominent lawyer who wrote law books, highest scorer ever on the Texas bar exam. This guy really knew his stuff, and I knew this guy since the day I was born because it happens to be my father. And I said, what do you think of this? He took 3 hours to read the 5,000-word pamphlet. He was going over every single word. He came out and he said, I was absolutely correct, but they're not going to like me. Because I'm revealing that your marriage contract with the state allows the state to change the terms of that contract even after you're married. And that's just simply the terms. Karl Marx, we have on our website, we have Karl Marx's marriage contract with his wife. In those days, and this is the way they did it, you made up a marriage contract. You signed it, she signed it, maybe the parents signed it, and you filed it as a public document. And that was the contract. Nobody could change that contract. But that's not what you do anymore. You make a three-party contract. I didn't say it was three-party. They say it's three-party contract between you, your spouse, and the state. And they get to change the terms even after the contract.
Well, when I got married, and, you know, the pastor that performed the ceremony and my husband and I signed, you know, the marriage license thing. It didn't say anywhere in there that the state was a party. Well, it did in a way, but it didn't disclose to me and my husband that they could change and intervene and do whatever they wanted whenever they wanted.
Well,
it disclosed
in the statutes, and if you look on people read all kinds of law all the time, but you need to understand the law of form, the law of the place. And if you went to your pastor, but your pastor went down to the county and asked the county for permission to fill out their marriage documents, If you take if you went and had a private marriage document made up and you signed it in front of witnesses and everything, and you went down, most counties will not file it. They will tell
you flat out,
and I've experimented with this. They will tell you that we only file our contracts, our marriage contracts. It's called a marriage contract. And it is clearly, on the face of it, a three-party contract. It's got the names of the party. Theirs are already printed up there. Your pastor, he gets to sign it because he's gone down and asked permission to sign it. And I'll show you now, we got pastors all over the country not wanting to perform gay marriages. And they can be forced to do that now. Why? Because they've not been working for Christ. They've been working for the government.
I agree with that.
They're a government officer filling out a government form and solemnizing a government contract between you, your spouse, and the state. And they've been publishing this in the law books for years. But we have a public school mentality. When I went down to get a marriage license years ago, been married for decades and decades, same woman, and I went down to get that marriage license, I actually asked the clerk, why do we have to get a marriage license?
Right.
And they gave me an answer that was not really true, but it sounded good. But I did the same thing when I first got my driver's license. I asked my father, that attorney, he was giving me instructions on how to drive a car. Why do we have to get a driver's license?
Well, we'll answer that question on the other side of the break.
We'll get back.
All right, so again, don't leave. Don't touch that webpage. Don't touch that dial. We will be back with the answer in a bit. Okay, we're back, and we're going to answer the question, why do I need a marriage license?
You need a marriage license in order to obtain benefits.
And what
benefits? You don't need a marriage license to be married. We have another pamphlet that you can read on our website, our article, The International Acceptance of Holy Matrimony. When the church marries you, I mean the real church, not somebody who's gone down and asked permission to be an officer of the state, but and like I was saying, once you do that, they can start regulating, you know, which marriages you must perform and which marriages you can reject. But and that's only a matter of time. We're already starting to see that. But a church marriage, a true church marriage, a church when we use define the word church as that which was established by Jesus Christ, it's not incorporated to the state. It's not a part of the state. The ministers aren't members of the state. They're ordained to God. They don't have any right to the benefits of the state. They are a separate, they live in the world, but they don't live of the world. And again, that word world in the Greek text is defined in the standard concordance, the constitutional order or system of government. That's what you were not to be of if you wanted to be one of Jesus' disciples. You didn't have any right to the free bread of Rome. And so when you have ministers like that, when they perform a marriage ceremony, they won't go down to the state and ask permission to fill out their contract. They will solemnize whatever contract those people bring to him. He will do it before witnesses, and he is not a party to the contract. He is simply solemnizing the contract. And that person is married. Everywhere they go, almost in every country, will recognize that those people are married, but not necessarily for benefit purposes. And so it may not get you the benefits. It will in some states, in some states it won't. But that's not, the church is not here to help you get the benefits of Nimrod and Cain and men who exercise authority. They're supposed to be here providing you the benefits of Christ through faith, hope, and charity and that perfect law of liberty Paul kept talking about, that daily ministration you see the apostles providing. That's what holy matrimony is. And the minister can't change that contract. Now, if that person wants benefits from the state, the church can't stop them from going and getting them, but they will probably have to go down and get a state marriage license. I mean, there's a whole history of marriage licenses from the state. And okay. Actually, the first place you see it instituted is Marie Antoinette's brother in Austria. And he suddenly said that all marriages are going to be done by the civil authorities. And he enforced that with an army. But that's not the way it was, and they still recognize holy matrimony. But anyway, I know we have a limited amount of time. But
Right, because I want to get to this, because regardless of how I feel about these things, because I still am not, maybe the marriage contract, maybe, but not the Social Security at all. I don't agree with that at all. I'm not persuaded that way.
Hold on. Okay.
But what I want to know, assuming for argument's sake that it is, and you feel like I feel that using that number, now that I've lived, you know, decades on this planet, I said, you know what, I just can't sin anymore with this. I'm not going to sin anymore with this number. I'm not going to sin anymore with any requirements that they have of me for this number, for me to use it or whatever. I'm just not going to use it anymore because to me it's sin, and they can't force me to sin. I have to repent of that, and I have to say, no, I'm not doing this anymore. So assuming that it's a contract, how do you get out of not violating God anymore and saying to them, whether it's a contract or not, I rescind it? Whether they accept the rescission, I don't know. I don't really care. I'm just not going to use it. How do you deal with that in this world when their requirement of this, if it were a contract thing, they're saying, oh, you contracted to do this. I said, no, well, sorry, too bad. Because at the very least, there was failure to disclose. There was misrepresentation. There were all kinds of things that within contract law would make it of no effect. It would make it void. So that's the way I see it. So how do you do it?
And I understand all those arguments. And the thing is the Social Security card is has on it a Social Security number.
Mm-hmm.
A Social Security number has a multifaceted purposes. It is also a federal employee identification number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I quote from the book written by the guy who devised the whole plan. And he does admit that it was sold as if it was insurance, but it's not insurance.
Right,
you don't
that's why it's not a contract.
You don't put money on deposit in an account that's held for you when you retire. What it is a system of Corbin. And in the same place where you were reading that article on not so secure Social Security, there's another page called Corbin, C-O-R-B-A-N.
Yes.
Same exact system was set up by Herod. He designed it after a system that was already set up in Rome, mostly by Augustus Caesar. And it was a system of social welfare that included what they call, it's a French word, corvée. In the Old Testament, we translate it as tribute. That you become a member, a bona fide numbered, they actually... Herod actually numbered people when they joined his system of Corbin, and you got an ID stone that identified you. And he actually, if you were a Jew, he would baptize you. He was baptizing before John the Baptist people into what he called the kingdom of heaven. But once you were in there, you had to pay in. They guaranteed you if the money was available. That's the trick clause. If the money's available, they guarantee to give it out as benefits. But if it's not available, you don't get anything.
Right.
But you have to pay in.
Well, no, I don't agree with that either, because you don't have to pay in unless there is an event that causes you to pay in.
Well, right. And again, that's back to that corvée thing, and I explain that also on the website. A corvée is a system of statutory labor where a portion of your labor belongs to the king or the state or whatever. And that's what you do. You waive a right. In order to get that number, you will waive a right to a portion of your labor. And your parents will do it. And they will do it in order to obtain you as a deduction on their taxes. And that's why it says in the Bible, in the New Testament, through your covetous practices, you will curse your children. What they're doing, cursing, is almost always involving debt in the Bible. When you see that word curse, they're cursing you with debt. Because you're a beneficiary, when the system goes bankrupt, which it already has, because there is no division of funds, you become a surety for debt. Now, you can stop using the number anytime you want. According to the head of the Social Security Administration, if you don't like it, don't use the number.
Right.
And if you stop using the number, that's fine. But you're still a surety, and they state in the State Department and the laws that they can follow you for 10 years, and if they want, the State Department can add more years to that 10 years. And that they publish all this stuff, but people don't read it. How many people you know read the Social Security Act? I'm probably the only one you're talking to that ever read the act. And I read the book by the guy who wrote the act. And I read the subsequent changes in the act. And even before Title 42, Section 666, said that you had to have a Social Security number to get any kind of a license. You can't even get that marriage license without a Social Security number now. It's in Title 42, Section 666 of the United States Codes. You can't get a driver's license. You can't get national ID, which is going online in October. You can't get any of these things that the government offers. You have to have that number, or you can't participate. Try to get a bank account without that number.
Right, I understand all that, and I understand that
it's the mark of the beast.
Well, okay, we're not using that number at all.
Uh-huh.
And so how does one in this world, how does a Christian in this world handle being in the world and not sinning against God with this number? Because
okay.
I don't
well,
want to sin anymore.
Well, one thing, I'm not telling people that have the number that they're sinning when they're using it. I'm explaining how the number works.
No, I understand,
the fact
but
is,
I want to know the answer to
right,
my question.
Right, and there is an answer. And I don't know if we'll get to it by the end of the show, but I'll give you a shot. I'll give you a brief version. We can always do this again.
Absolutely.
Right now, the only way I have found that somebody can give out of the system is they have to literally come out of the system naked. And this is what the apostles were doing. This is why Jesus said, in order to be one of my disciples, and a disciple is a student, that's the ones he was training to be the ministers of his church.
Right.
He was training them to be those ministers. You're my little flock. I'm going to appoint unto you a kingdom. And he says, I'm going to take a kingdom away from the Pharisees, and I'm going to give it to the little flock. And he does.
Yeah.
And he says, but you can't be like the governments of the Gentiles. So he's appointing this government. If you go back to that 1 Peter 2:13, and you go up to, I think, around verse 11 or 10, he's talking about you weren't a people, and now you are a people. He's saying that his apostles have to give up all their benefits. They have
okay.
to give up all, he actually uses a word there that means property. They didn't translate it. He said, give up all you had. And they didn't
yeah.
translate the word property because the church people at the time didn't want you to know what a minister has to do in order to be a true ordained minister of Christ. They have provisions in the law, and we go through this in the book Free Church Report, that if you do that and you actually become a part of the church established by Christ as a minister of Christ, you're excluded from Social Security. You're not exempted. You're excluded.
Right.
You can't even use the number unless you fill out an SS-16. This is all in there. It explains it all in the law, but people are missing it because they don't understand the kingdom of God. Now, the individual congregant who is not a minister, how does he get out? And that's what everybody wants to know. Well, for a time being, you may have to pay your tally of bricks, just like in the days of Egypt, because that's where you're at. You're back in Egypt again. Except for the contract in Egypt was you had to pay 20% of everything you made in a year to the government. And they would provide you with grain and, you know, leeks and onions and all these free benefits. But Moses comes along and says, no, you're going to have to get your benefits by gleaning in the field at night. You may still have to pay your tally of bricks. During hard times, what the Bible refers to is darkness and clouds. And but when you do that, you're going to learn the art and skills of the kingdom of God, how they bind themselves together with pure religion, not doctrines that people memorize, but love for one another. Pure religion. Remember, James says pure religion is taking care of the widows and orphans and needy of your society, unspotted by the world. Again,
right.
What word did he use for world? Not the one for age, not one for inhabited places, but the one that is defined in the concordance, constitutional order or system of government. When the congregants start doing that, they can opt out. But until they start doing that, they will not be free.
We're going to have you back to discuss that portion.
I hear the music.
Okay? So I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and perhaps next week we'll discuss how to opt out. Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Okay, thank you for having me. God bless.
All righty, bye-bye.